This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
He's Nick McMahon, and he's next.
And now, from the legendary Studio B, so you're in Seattle with Gregor.
A gentle touch with humanity means people are charmed by Nick's easygoing eagerness to experience things. He's played in a touring rock band, traveled like a seed on the wind through Southeast Asia, seemingly without much direction, happy to land where the current takes him, and most recently spent a season learning about the apple crops of Washington by getting his hands dirty for harvest. A guy that takes time to think about what it all means, not from the comfort of the couch, but with a stroll through the very places where we live and breathe.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Hey.
Hey, that sounds really nice. You're the, warm and...
You're the one who has to turn it up. I think that's funny. The guy who's played in rock bands, ears blown out. Let's crank that up.
Yeah.
Did you guys ever get into in-ears? Did you ever try get to that point?
Our drummer was on in-ears the whole time because basically to hear what's going on as a drummer...
It's got to be impossible,
yeah.
Dude.
It's still impossible, but yeah, I mean, he would just have them cranked up. Like, he had a metronome going, so.
Oh, yeah, so you got it. Yeah.
But that's really good, because you play way tighter with a metronome, and...
Yeah, I know people, like, argue against it, because they're like, it takes away from the organic feel of it. I'm like, well, also, you get to be a pro a lot faster when you...
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think that anyone in professional music is probably mostly using a metronome, unless you're, like... really against it and want to be organic.
That first Rage Against the Machine album, I remember trying to make an edit of one of the songs, like Killing in the Name of or something, and you try and find a sample from the mid part and put it at the end to get rid of a curse or something like that, yeah. And they didn't play to a metronome.
Oh, geez, yeah.
And I'm like, wow, that's crazy, because that's such a huge, it's such a prolific album, and it's just like, it sounds like they just kind of like did it.
Yeah, I think if you're an amazing musician, maybe, you know, don't play to a metronome, because you can just let your... amazingness shine through.
You know, I think about how the monitors on stage are like so loud for some people, and then like people switch to in-ears, and that's gotta actually be worse for your hearing.
I'm sure it's worse for your hearing. Yeah.
Does anyone wear like over-ears? Is there anyone out there that's like rocking over-ear headphones?
You mean like since the guy in Linkin Park was doing it in like the 90s?
Oh, yeah, that's right. That? I forgot about that.
That was his image.
Yeah, the guitar player or something like that. Yeah. He had the smart guy. I bet his hearing's way better than most people's, because the over ears are way better for you than the in ears.
Yeah, yeah, probably.
Anyway, we're now 2 minutes into monitor talk. That's fantastic. Nick, I don't even remember how I met you. I guess you just started working as a street teamer here.
I started with the Mountain.
Oh, yeah? You got the look. You got the... maybe then you didn't.
Well, I think I wanted to work for the N because I listened to the N, but the Mountain was the only one that...
Are you a Seattle
hiring.
Guy?
I grew up in Linwood.
Yeah, okay. So, I mean, you're from
the area.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Born and raised?
Yeah, yeah. I went to Deck the Hall Ball in, like, in high school and saw Disturbed and Sum 41 and, you know, all that shameful day.
I don't know if I'm sorry to hear that or if I'm glad that you've been around for that long. That's.
I mean, I thought it was awesome when I was in 10th grade.
Yeah.
But
yeah, Disturbed. Ooh-ah. I don't have the. I think I have a cut of it even. No, I don't. Damn it. Well, that's crazy. I had no idea that you had such roots here. Your folks live in Linwood?
Yeah, my dad grew up in Lake Forest Park.
Oh, wow. So, like, long time Seattle stuff.
My grandpa grew up in Seattle. My grandpa went to UW. My uncle went to UW. I went to UW.
Wow. Yeah, you went to college. I didn't even know that part.
I went to college.
Yeah, wow. What'd you study?
Comparative history of ideas.
How's that going?
That's what I'm doing. That's what I'm doing with my life.
Yeah, you're like traveling around comparing different ideas of history.
Yeah, kind of.
It's
actually
fascinating.
Kind of.
I just watched the movie Ip Man. My poor wife, when she listens to this, she's gonna be like, "Shut up about this movie already." It's a kung fu movie from China.
Sweet.
Starring Donnie Yen, and like at the end of it, spoiler alert. Okay, at the end of it, it goes, then the Chinese people finally defeated the Japanese, bringing an end to World War II. And I was like, hold on. That's not...
Wait, what's it called?
Ip Man, IP
Man. Okay,
M-A-N.
IP Man.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I've seen that. Great movie.
Yeah, it's great.
I mean, you know, maybe not factual, but...
Well, I mean, but from their perspective, maybe it is. And that's kind of what that whole world is, right? It's about the...
That's very true, yeah. Your perspective?
Yeah.
That's the word?
Yeah.
You know, wherever you are is different wherever you are.
Yeah, I mean, and to them, like, they got rid of the Japanese and the war for them was over.
Yeah.
Never mind the fact that, like, America was unleashing hellish bombs on the Japanese that had to, yeah, like, curtail their behavior a little bit, but...
Well, in Vietnam, they call the war the American War.
Do they really?
Yeah, they have an American War Museum, whereas we have, like, Vietnam War, so...
Whoa.
And they're, like, the American invaders, and... Yeah.
That's crazy. That's so... you've been to Vietnam, obviously, and not... To everyone listening, probably not, obviously, but... Yeah. Tell me, what's their English speaking ability like there?
It's not as good as some other places in that part of the world, but
because we went to Japan recently and they don't speak awesome English there, but they were good, man. If Japanese people come here, you're screwed because no one speaks any Japanese here. The amount of English that they spoke was enough that I could get by asking the right questions or whatever.
Yeah.
And I don't speak any Japanese. I learned 10 words and that was like how I got by.
Yeah.
But there were some Canadian tourists there that were like, you know, Japan is the worst. These people are idiots. And Vietnam, where we came from, their English was 100 times better.
I mean, after I'd been in Thailand Thailand before I was in Vietnam. And so compared to Thailand, the English isn't as good.
So I'm fascinated by this whole idea that you went just to the Far East.
Yeah, well, I mean, some people might, like close friends and stuff, might have thought it was a little bit of a surprise or spontaneous trip, but it was kind of a long time coming for me. I studied that in college.
Oh, yeah.
I studied Buddhism and Southeast Asian anthropology.
Really?
And like a girlfriend of mine at the time was half Filipino, and she was like going to the Philippines with her mom, and I just remember being really interested in that area. I took like a non-Western architecture class at the UW, and I loved it all, and I was just like so amazed by how different their buildings and language and everything about their life was. And it was like, you know, we have the same thing every day, it's our life, this is where we live, and wanting to have a different view or see something that was not the way I lived was something that I'd been interested in a long time and felt obligated to stay here because of my musical endeavors. And
okay, well, let's go chronologically a little bit here.
Okay.
When did you start? You were in Girl on Fire.
I was in Girl on Fire. But at the same time, I was going to the UW.
Okay.
And studying this stuff.
Okay, so, but when did Girl on Fire start?
In 2007.
Where were you? Like, what?
I started, where was I? Like,
yeah, in your life, where were you? Like, were you in college? Were you in high school?
Yeah, I was like a sophomore in college.
Okay, so you started a rock band with some friends in school?
Yeah,
or?
Yeah, well, one of them I went to high school with, a couple of guys I had been working with, and... it was like, I mean, I've been playing music since I was in high school, and it was like, let's start a rock band. Yeah, it's going to be great. And then our singer was crazy. I can't swear on this, can I?
Sure, go ahead. I don't care.
Okay, well, he was a crazy and he was just like, I'm buying a van, I'm buying a trailer, I'm buying all the amps we need. So he got himself in like 15 grand in debt, you know, or something like that. But we had our rock band set up, ready to go. And he also worked at Robert Lang Studios.
Yeah, sure.
North, or he was interning there / kind of working.
That's a great studio. I've been through there.
We got a bunch of recording time, and we started playing, like, Showbox. We did, like, a Showbox show, when you were selling your own tickets. You know, it's really but it's, like...
Yeah.
It's fun, you know?
Yeah, of course. I mean, it's a hustle.
I was, like, 19 years old. And I was like, this is great. And he's like, we're going to do this. We're going to be poor-ish musicians, and we're going to... go tour the country. But at the same time, I was like, and I'm going to go to college.
Smart.
So went to college. And then the same year I graduated college, we got signed to a record label. Century Media, like that kind of metal label that's based out of Germany originally.
Yeah.
Some LA roots now. And that just kind of took off. It was slow from the perspective of me, but from the perspective of like our fans and stuff. It was like, we released a record, we went on a national tour, came back, recorded a record in LA, went on like tours for a year and a half.
That's so crazy. Did you get to leave the country for touring at all?
Just Canada.
Okay.
But it kind of felt like a different country when you like arrive in Montreal and wake up and everyone's speaking French and they're bonjour, bonjour. And you're like, oh, and what? I was in New York last night.
And the French Canadians are pricks, man. You go down, like we were there and go to the coffee shop one day and like, bonjour, parlez-vous anglais? And they're like, yeah, duh. We're next door to U.S., dude. And I'm like, okay, fine. The next morning I come down, I'm like, good morning. And they're like, bonjour. And it's the same guy. And I'm like, you're a dick. Stupid French Canadians.
Well, these kids were pretty pumped that this like sure. band from the West Coast was there. And we of were course. Just like, you know, young, ridiculous. Let's get messed up. And
yeah, of course. You were there to party and like be rock stars.
Yeah. So I think that perspective was a good time for us to be doing that. And
Montreal is lovely. Not to totally crap on Montreal. I think it's one of the best cities I've been to.
I was there for about 5 hours. So okay. you definitely saw more than me.
You stopped, played, and then kept going?
We had to be in Toronto the next day, and I think we like left that night. And yeah.
But is this still touring in like a van? Is this still the van that your buddy bought?
It was van and trailer style.
Oh my god! Did you ever have any problems with people stealing your stuff? I know that's a huge problem for bands.
Not too much. In New York, some people stole like a pedal, but that wasn't out of the trailer. We never had anyone break into our trailer. We had like the special locks that weren't that easy, and we were usually pretty careful about trying to park in safer spots. And
yeah,
it was all right. I think you know. One time in the early days, a bass guitar was missing, and you know, one time in the middle days, a bass guitar was found.
Now, what do your parents think of you, like running around the country in a rock and roll band?
They're super supportive.
On. Yeah,
yeah, they're like, that's awesome. You know, this is a good time in your life to try to do this if it's something you're enjoying doing. And
how do they feel about you going to school?
Well, they were really pushing for me to go to school, especially my mom, you know, was like, go to college. Yeah. And like when I got into the UW, she probably would have been happy if I did like accounting or business and or chemistry or something. And I actually was really into science in high school, math and science. I was always really did well on those. And then in like my freshman year in college, I took an English class that I actually really enjoyed. One of the first times I enjoyed an English class. And in the UW, I started doing kind of, I guess, philosophy, cultural studies, and ended up doing, well, it's called CHID, but Comparative History of Ideas, which is sort of identity, culture studies. And
yeah.
That was a lot more writing and not very much mathematics, but.
It's fascinating. This isn't about me, but I'm going to make it for a second. We'll just take a quick turn.
Yeah.
I went to the University of Arizona, and I was offered, or I was told I was in a media arts program, and media arts to me was like, sound and TV and movies and all that. And it turns out at the University of Arizona for your first year or maybe first three semesters, it's only film. And I really had no desire to do film. I'm not a film guy, like dumb movies with stupid punchlines. It's just like what I'm into. I'm just thinking like really low bass dude movies, you know? And so I didn't know where to go from there. And I was getting bad grades. I didn't know where to turn. And I turned to Southeast Asian studies.
Oh, wow.
And got like super into the identities of the Far East. And I spent a little more than a year in this department taking these classes and like learning about just a whole other mindset of the world. Like we think of ourselves as like dominant and the prevailing culture, but like we're seriously outnumbered by the rest of the planet.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was fascinating to get a little bit of perspective that way. And I, like you, just, you know, I went to Japan. That's the first time I've left the country other than Canada or Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And to see a difference and like lit up and like got to experience what that actually is. Because it's very similar. The Japanese are very similar to Americans, but the way they get there is different. And it's fantastic.
That's
interesting. That's a cool parallel that like I never knew that you had like set up a background. My parents very disappointed in me for doing that. They already wanted me to be a doctor or a businessman or an engineer or something like that. And I was there like taking, you know, Buddhism practice and culture or something like that as a class. And they're like, oh, God.
Yeah, I think I got, I mean, I don't know whether I got lucky or what, but my dad was into meditation and yoga a little bit when he was in his 20s and into like, I don't know, just healthness, well-being, health, well-beingness.
Healthness, I like
healthness.
That.
No, let's go with it. It's big league.
Coin
awesome.
That, yeah.
yeah, and so I was always really, a lot of what I did in college was learning about ways to think about things and explain things. And so I think that helped in explaining things to them.
Yeah.
It's like, all right, you know, this is actually beneficial to me because it's helping me have a broader view and understanding of the world and people. And whether or not I'm going to go and get a job in a dentist office or, yeah. you know, a business building. you know, I'm going to understand people and I'll be able to be fine anywhere I am in the world and work with people.
What do they do?
My dad was, or did HVAC.
Yeah, okay.
My mom was a...
Was he an engineer? Like a...
just like HVAC repair cool. and installation.
Working
and,
man.
And yeah, and so he's been working for the city of Bellevue doing like building management.
Yeah, cool.
My mom was working as a transcriber, medical transcriber, which probably isn't a job that exists anymore because everyone just
robots.
Talks. Yeah, robots. Robots control us. And school teacher.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah,
so just like humble, modest background.
Yeah. Yeah.
Educated.
Yeah.
Interesting. That's so fascinating. So then you got an opportunity to play in a band and just like cruise around and see, like be an artist for a while.
Yeah. So of course I wasn't going to, I actually, maybe not of course, because I had a friend that was in the band and as we were getting signed, he quit the band. He was just like, this isn't for me. I don't want to be more invested into this. And we're like, are you crazy? Like we're getting signed to a label. We're going to get someone to pay for us to go into a recording studio, which is like, every 22-year-old rock band kid's dream,
yeah.
or any age for that matter, is like someone's going to pay for you to go record your music.
Yeah.
And that was exciting. And
do you own that music now?
No, they own the stuff that they paid for.
Do you get to own it at some point?
Maybe. I don't know.
Do you care?
No, I don't really care. Yeah. It was like the experience that we had was really great and being able to record in some really cool studios with some really cool people and tour around the country was the experience that I got out of it.
Yeah.
I guess I haven't thought about it a whole lot lately.
Yeah.
Just cause it was sort of like, I was really ready to be done with it when I got out of it. So it was like, I'm done.
Well then a couple rap questions in for that. Like, do you end up now being responsible for the money that they loaned you? Are you like,
well, that was a big thing. So, you know, they would send us, you know, this is how much you owe the record label, which is, it was like 80 grand. And we're like, well, that's how much Girl on Fire, the LLC band, owes the label.
Who was smart enough to do that?
Well, you figure that you have to work with lawyers and stuff when
yeah.
we were signed for 4 years.
Okay.
So, you know, and we had two different contracts between like a subsidiary label and the yeah. actual label and a management contracts that changed a couple times. And so you have to get a lawyer.
Yeah.
And like, it's an expense that kind of sucks. And it used to be, I think, that labels would actually pay for the lawyers for the band because they, you know, they were like, you know, let's not screw our bands over. But then that all changed in the 90s and stuff when the music industry was like really banking on CDs and
yeah.
Yeah. So we just were like, we have to make sure that we aren't personally indebted,
right, right.
indebted to them.
So,
which it was fine. They were like, yeah, of course, you know, and LLCs in our country are viewed, and I think
limited
mostly,
liability corporation or something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah. They're viewed as almost as a person, you know, they can be taken to court. They can be sued. You can owe money. They can pay money as separate from any individual,
but you're not personally on the hook for that money. Just the idea of
right. The idea of Girl on Fire.
So if you like fired the band back up and started doing stuff, that money would have to go to that label.
Certain parts of the money, like money that you make from the show,
oh
make
my God.
From merch wouldn't have to, but then money you make from, you know, like online sales and probably like trackable money would have to.
Oh my God, that's so crazy, dude.
But
80 yeah. grand?
Yeah, it's like 80 grand.
So, I mean, the label just eats that, right?
Yeah, but, you know, then they have some other band that blows up or, you know, makes some money and...
yeah. It's calculated risk here.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I could talk for hours about the label situation and the industry of that nature, but...
it seems a little counterproductive, I guess.
counterproductive.
Well, when that comes to an end, like, how do you feel about, like... forgive me, this is not a nice question to ask, okay? But how do you feel about being another band that didn't make it? You had 4 years where you were taken care of, but it didn't pan out where you're a big mega star touring... you know, the world or whatever.
Right, right. Well, you know, I think with every time this kind of thing happens, it's never just like one person. You know, we feel a lot of the responsibility was mishandled by the label and by management,
mm-hmm.
but they probably would say that a lot of the responsibility was mishandled by us, you know? And
sure.
When we were doing recording and touring and stuff, like it was great. But, you know, in hindsight, I can be like, wow, every time I was on a break, I should have been taking guitar lessons. I should have been taking vocal lessons. I should have been stepping up and trying to promote myself and promote my band harder, instead of being like, I'm home now for 2 weeks, I'm gonna party with my friends and like see my family. And
but how much is that part of it, you know, like
how much of your identity as a musician relies on your ability to socialize with you? Like, you can't lock yourself in a vacuum,
right? But I could have tried harder. Okay, and everyone sure. could have tried harder. And I'm, you know, I don't know if anyone in my band will actually listen to this or hear this, but
I'm sending it to all of them.
Oh shit. But yeah, that, you know, like, if we had all been like, every day that we're off, we're spending an hour, you know, practicing our instrument, and we're going to be professional musicians, and this is what we're going to do with our lives. Yeah. Like, it was like, hey, this is what we're going to do with our lives, but it's a lot more fun to just like screw around and enjoy ourselves, which is what we did. And that's partly awesome to go through that experience, just enjoying yourself and kind of going with the flow and be like, all right, we're on this tour, or we're on this tour, and that's great. And yeah, I mean,
what kind of bad blood exists within Girl on Fire since the demise?
I mean, I like all the guys still. I see them all.
Cool.
A big reason why I left the band was like, my really good friend was gonna have a baby with his girlfriend, and so he was like, I'm out. And I kind of felt like I was doing a lot of the management stuff and trying to get the music together and trying to make it happen, and everyone else sort of was like, let's smoke weed. And I was like,
it's legal now, Nick. We can do it for real.
And I was like, that's fine. Like, let's smoke weed, but I don't want to feel like I'm doing all this. And I was feeling less and less engaged in it. And there was a couple, you know, other things that happened where I just,
it's a lot of weight to carry, man.
You know? Yeah. I just was kind of over it basically. And I was like, I don't want to be running this whole project and not feel like you guys are as into it as I am. And I don't feel into it. So
how does it feel to be away from it now? What, a couple of years later?
Well, let's see. It was a year in September, our last show. And like, our last couple shows were really fun. The last tour we went on was last in summer of 2015. And that was like one of the most fun I'd had on tour in a couple of years. But yeah, I mean, you definitely miss playing music in front of people, which is something I could do again, and I probably will do it again at some point. And
do you have enough clout? Do you think that, like, if you wanted to start a band, you think people would be like, "Oh yeah, that's the guy from Girl on Fire"?
I don't know.
That's a hard question. I'm sorry, but
I mean, yeah, you know, like, we definitely had people that were following us, and whatever Facebook numbers count for, if anything, these days.
Yeah, your buddy Nicholas, man, he's got like a gazillion Twitter followers. And
right, and you can follow a lot of people and engage them, and that builds up its own momentum, for better or for worse. And how engaged those people are, you know, it's hard to say. You know, I honestly think to start a band, from my perspective and from my level of well-knownness, I'd have to, you know, really push it. I have to do like local shows and do free stuff and pass stuff out and try to get on every radio station that I can, and, you know, do the groundwork and the grunt work, which is something that I've thought about. Is like, I know what it would take probably to get going and, you know, to get to the next level and the next level. And, you know, it's always about, with sort of anything in life, it's always about like those levels that you go through. Not necessarily like a video game, but it's not like Donkey Kong levels, but it's sort of like you see where you are, and you see other people around you, and you see this person that's, you know, a little bit further. They're maybe making money doing it, or maybe they're just getting the better shows, or maybe they're getting that tour or that label or whoever. And you like, what does it take to get to what they're doing? And I don't know. I mean, it's something I didn't really realize as when we were doing the band. You know, you kind of see it, but then afterwards, when you look back, you're like, ah, that's what it would take.
Yeah, to be able to stand back is nice, I guess, to be able to get perspective.
So I think I have more perspective now, but whether I'm motivated in that direction is something I'm still kind of like, I don't know. I mean, I like making music. I've been making music my whole life, basically.
Are you still making music now? Are you doing anything?
Yeah, I'm recording my own stuff. And I'm enjoying it, and it's different than Girl on Fire, and a lot different, but I've always made like my own kind of music. I just never really, it was more of just like an artistic release for me.
Sure.
Like, some people like to go home and paint. I like to go home and make songs.
Who was the songwriter in that band?
It was collective for sure. Our singer did a lot of the vocals, and I did a lot of like the organization, kind of like production, I guess you could say, you know, really into like Pro Tools, editing,
oh, cool.
making sounds, and learned a lot going to studios. So when you're in the studio with a producer, you know, they're also influencing it and influencing the writing and the sound of the music. So a couple different producers influenced us, and we spent some time in LA doing writing with like other bands and some people that the label that we were working with had contacts with.
Yeah, you don't. I don't think that most people realize when you get to that level where you're doing this professionally, how there's a lot of other hands that get involved at some point. It's not just, not everyone can be Fugazi and just lock themselves in a practice studio 5 hours a day for 5 days a week and take
right.
it as a job where they're writing music themselves without outsiders being in
right,
there.
Right.
There's a huge songwriting community in LA and in Nashville and stuff, and you can borrow people's talents to help you find the way to make that part a little bit better or a little catchier or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. And with that, it is similar, you know. It's sort of like, I don't know, what is it? Like shooting fish in a bucket, or is that
a barrel,
a phrase?
Yeah.
In a barrel?
Yeah.
You know, it's like these songwriters write a song every day for a whole year, and they do this for years and years and years, and they hope, you know, maybe one song a year gets picked up.
How crazy is it with Alan Thicke dying, like that he wrote like the Different Strokes song and the Family Ties, or the, excuse me, Facts of Life song,
yeah.
and like the original Wheel of Fortune song, and it's like, how many other things did he write that never like made it?
That people, yeah, yeah.
Or the,
that
oh,
people
yeah,
never
that
heard,
we,
or people
don't
that
know.
Don't know that he wrote.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, like ghostwriters and stuff are a big thing. I mean.
That's crazy.
It's crazy. I mean, the industry's obviously growing a lot. And
do you stay motivated? Like, can you, like, do you push yourself to make stuff, or do you find yourself?
After like listening to music, you know, like growing up, you listen to songs, and a song is, you know, a 2 to 4 minute piece of music usually with layers of instruments and frequently most likely vocals. And so when I started making music, it's like, I'm making songs, you know, I'm not just going to play guitar for half an hour and record that and be like, oh, that's sweet, half an hour of recorded guitar. You know, it's like, and I mean, maybe somebody would like to do that, and I'm sure somebody does that, but for me, I've always wanted to like make that song or make the product. And so, I guess like I start a lot of songs or music parts, or just sometimes I'll be enjoying myself, playing some drum sounds, not playing real drums, fake drums.
Yeah.
And guitar, and you know, you might have like 20 starts, and then you have one that you're like, oh, this is really cool, and you kind of just follow it and see where it goes, and then it might become, you know, like an actual song. And so yeah, I guess, you know, if I feel inspired, then I get motivated, and then I almost can't, you know, stop. I can't just be like, oh, I got like so close to finishing it, and then I'm not gonna do anything anymore. I want to finish it.
So are you good about finishing?
So sort of. I mean, it comes and goes. You know, sometimes I'll be really motivated for a week and I'll get a lot done. And lately, I have a couple, I guess I would say, songs that I'm pretty close to finishing that I'm more motivated on than I've been in a while. And, you know, like when I was in the band, it was more about finishing songs for the band. So I didn't really do my own stuff to that extent. And so that's kind of like nice for me to get back into.
You ever go back and hear one of your old songs and still think like, ah, we could have changed it to be like this?
Oh yeah, for sure. Or you go back and you hear your old song and you're like, ah, man, if we had put that at the right place at the right time, it would have been like, it would have been good. You know, people would have been listening to it. People would have been into it. Because you hear other songs and you're like, that song's not as good as our song. I'm biased. I'm probably biased.
So you hang it up now. It was a year ago or whatever. And then you're a surprise to some, but not to anyone who really knew you, that you decide that you're going to, it's a long time coming. You're just going to pack up and leave, man.
Yeah.
First of all, where did you go first? How did you get there? And how long did it take you to set the whole thing up to get out of town?
I booked my ticket like a week and a half before I left.
Okay.
And that was partly because I was going through a traffic court situation, which got cleared up and, you know, all good. And like the day after, or maybe the day of, I got home and booked my ticket because I knew I didn't have to go back to any more traffic court.
Oh, that's cool.
Stuff.
And where'd you go first?
Thailand.
So you decided, I'm going to go to Thailand. I remember talking to you. I was like, when are you coming back? You're like, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, so I have a good friend that I've known since I was like a teenager, and when he was 17, he moved to Thailand and worked as a dive instructor for about a year.
Wow.
And with like a friend that had a business that he knew, I don't know, yeah. And then he came back and, you know, 4 or 5 years later went back to Thailand and worked again for, you know, like 6 months and traveled around Asia. So he was going to Thailand with his girlfriend for 3 weeks in that a year ago in December. And I was like, I should go with you. And he's like, yeah, dude, meet me there. And so I met him there. And
oh, cool.
I was on and off with, like, I'd meet up with him and his girlfriend for a while, and then I'd go off and do my own thing, and they'd kind of go do a couple's thing. But it was really fun. I mean, so yeah, so I went to Thailand, flew into Bangkok. That's a crazy place.
Why?
It's just, I mean, coming, my first time in a foreign, like, third world type country, or, I mean, they're pretty developed, especially in Bangkok. It doesn't really seem third worldish in the sense of some places that I've seen now, but it's just like the traffic's crazy. The language is different. They're driving on the other side of the road.
Yeah, it's the weirdest.
I mean, coming from Seattle and drive, or just even touring around America, it's very different. But I think my touring experience has helped me a lot with my traveling experiences.
What did you bring with you?
Like just being able to go with it and not being stressed when.
What did you physically bring with you?
Physically, I thought you meant like, you know.
What from America did you?
What from America? I'm like,
what emotional baggage did you bring with you? That's fair too, though, man. I guess I shouldn't cut you off. Yeah.
I mean, yeah, I brought just a big backpack full of clothes, and that's about it. I brought too many shoes, too many clothes, but I'd pack differently now.
I mean, you'd have no way of knowing that, though, right?
But, yeah.
So you just have a pack. You're just like, your backpack, let's go.
Yeah, yeah.
And you could stay for a month or six?
You can stay for 1 month in Thailand before you have to either reapply for a visa or do something to stay longer. Or you can leave and come back in. And so I was going to just travel around with him for 3 weeks. And then I had this Australian girlfriend that she was meeting me in Thailand after he left, like just after New Year's. So I kind of had, you know, like...
Wait, when did you get there? You got there like right before Christmas or something?
Yeah, I got there like December 10th.
Okay.
And then, so I was going to travel with him for 3 weeks, and then he was going to fly home. And then like a week after he flew home, she was going to meet me in Thailand, and we were going to travel for 5 weeks. So that's, you know, like over two months now of planning. Not really planned, but sort of like loose plans to go around Thailand. And then once she came, we wanted to kind of travel around like Vietnam and Cambodia, Laos, and see those parts, because, 5 weeks is a lot of time, but another one of those things, when you look back, you could, with unlimited time or without necessarily a time limit for me, I guess it wasn't necessarily unlimited, but I didn't have a specific return date. I probably wouldn't have, it's better to just not have a plan and just kind of like go to a place and like find kind of whatever it is that you're looking for until you're ready to go to the next place. Mm-hmm. And so with her, once we were traveling together, we were like, all right, let's go to the next place. We didn't stay in a place for more than like 1 or 2 days for like 3 weeks straight, which gets really exhausting.
Yeah. Right.
And kind of, for me not having to leave, I was sort of like, oh, I want to stay here. And she's like, but we got to go here. And I'm like, oh, but like, I guess I can come back. And
well, how did you make this all? Like, did you just have a gazillion dollars saved up ready to go? Or did you just...
Well, it's pretty cheap. I mean, I feel like you could do about $1,000 a month.
Wow.
And that includes like food, accommodation, and travel expenses.
Did you have enough money to just get home? Just like saved up or something? Or
yeah, yeah. I mean, I'd saved up money for a while, and like my parents were supportive, and they're like, if you run into, you know,
if you're in jail,
yeah, let us know. And you know, it's good to stay out of jail, definitely.
Yeah.
I didn't have to bribe anyone, but that's not necessarily uncommon, that like the police are kind of posted up in places, and you're driving by, and they don't really care if you're going fast, but they'll just stop everyone and be like, you just give them some money, and then it's cool, and it's just like totally normal. But it's usually a lot, you know, it's like equivalent of maybe like $5 US or something.
Yeah.
Whereas here it's like, if you're speeding and you get a ticket, it's like, you know, $100 to $200 US. So there's some weird like similarities, because the police here are looking for people breaking the law, whereas the police there are just sort of looking for people to give them money. But
wow, that's so weird.
It's like same but different, you know?
Now, you weren't just gone for 2 months though, man, right? You were gone
I was gone for 7 months.
Yeah. And so, and you went there knowing that for 2 months, you'd be gone.
Yeah, I was like, I'll be gone for 2 months. Maybe I'll travel on my own for a month and be ready to come home. But I want to at least have the option to stay as long as I want. I had a family wedding, which I had missed some of that kind of family stuff when I was on tour in the band, and I was like, this isn't a good enough excuse, just me doing my own thing to miss that stuff. So I was like, I'll be home by July at the latest, which I was home in July, and I was like, are you sure I have to come home? And I was like, I want it. Like, I was, you know, having this little discussion with myself where I was like, I could mentally stay and continue to do this sort of traveling. But
how long did it take before, before you found a gear that was like, before you had like left your Seattle self behind a little bit and became traveling through Asia, Nick?
That's a good one. I think when you're traveling with other people, you're kind of distracted. You aren't really like just in yourself and in your experience of traveling. You're kind of like sharing that experience and, you know, making compromises. And so, especially when you're with people that are just there for a shorter period of time. And so I think I had potential to get to that gear sooner, maybe about the time my friends were leaving. I was like, I'm ready to do this. And then I was like, this girl's coming, and I was excited, but then part of me was a little like, but now I have to, you know, travel on her time frame a little bit, you know, I have to make a compromise, which it wasn't necessarily the best situation. But after she left, it took me a little while, because you go through this like emotional adjustment of traveling by yourself, and you feel kind of like you aren't experiencing these things with another person anymore.
Sure.
And you're always with people. You're always experiencing things with people, but you know, a person that you're close or really intimate with that you suddenly don't have traveling with you every day, it's like part of it was a relief because I'm like free, I can do whatever I want, I don't have to, you know, go to the next city. But the part of me was like, but I'm by myself. And so it's kind of weird. Yeah. I think when I got into Vietnam a second time, so that was probably about a month after she left, before I was really like, I got this. This is awesome. I can do this as long as I can.
Did you have to... Is there an amount of having to learn to trust your instincts when you're by yourself and not let yourself be crazy and like talk yourself out of things?
I mean, I'm pretty good at going with stuff, and I don't know what, like, I think that as much as I think of myself as really rational and like careful, I'm like kind of reckless and like maybe slightly self-destructive at times. And
what a combo.
You know, I might blame that on like my musical career or you know, drugs, but yeah. I think that there was a couple times where I got myself in places or situations where I was like, I don't feel safe, or, you know, I might get my stuff stolen or in trouble, sort of. But I guess trusting your instinct, it becomes something that's really important. You kind of know your, like, when you go through these experiences, you definitely kind of get to know your instinct better, which is, it's kind of weird. It's like, you know, it's always there. You know, you're always, everything you do throughout any day, you're thinking, should I do this? Should I not do this? Or whatever basic thing. But then when you're in these other places where people don't speak your language and there's no one there to like be like, hey, it's okay, like, you're fine, you kind of have to be okay with yourself.
Well, I can only imagine that, you know, it's not a sense like sight or touch or something like that, but the idea that you're just kind of comfy and you can go, you know what's safe and not safe here in the Seattle area. Like, yeah. For the most part, you know, you could still run across anomalies or whatever, but your instinct, your gut doesn't have to be as finely tuned here because you can kind of autopilot around.
Yeah.
I can only imagine when when everything is a variable that you're not familiar with, that your instinct has to like sharpen a little.
Yeah. It's like, you're sharp and you're like on it and you're kind of paying attention and making sure your stuff's safe. And then you kind of get comfortable and you start autopiloting, and then something happens and you're like, oh, okay, I can't autopilot. And
wow.
It kind of shocks you sometimes. Like there was a couple things that happened, which I don't know whether we want to get into story time now. Or
Yeah, sure. Like I'm fascinated by the concept of a guy who like journeys on kind of like a solo adventure. The part where you're with your friends, I'm actually kind of surprised by. I like the idea of just being lost. You have purpose, you're like existing, but like you just have to become part of the sea of other people. I don't like to take people that are here for granted, where they might not feel comfortable being amongst just white Seattle or whatever it is. Like, if you're here visiting by yourself and you don't know where you're going, that's got to be daunting to be here. I can only imagine the opposite way.
Right.
How fantastic it must be to develop character and stuff. So I like the idea of the specific stories, but I'm also upset. I like the concept of your mind being there.
Yeah. Well, it's really exciting, you know, like you get to a city and you don't know a single person or where you're going or what you're going to do. And, you know, you go to like a soup shop and you sit there and eat some soup and you look on, you know, the internet or the book or something. And, you know, I think everyone has different things that they're looking for while traveling. And so I think that's an important thing to have in mind is like, what are you looking for? And you run into travelers who, you know, I think they maybe knew what they're looking for at one point, but kind of lost what they're looking for. And they seem kind of like these lost people that are just in a city for like a month or something and they don't really do much. And they're like, seem kind of depressed. And you're like, whoa, this is kind of weird. Like you're over in Asia and you can do anything you want and you have enough money and you don't do anything and they aren't doing anything. It's just like they...
It's even decision paralysis or something like that. Yeah. Like, well, I don't have all these options. I don't know what to do.
Right, right. And so for me, I definitely wasn't just looking for like the tourist things.
Well, here's a question. What were you looking for?
Right, right. So developing from my early days in college through my time traveling as a band and...
You guys time traveled? That's crazy.
Time traveling. Yes, time traveling. I mean, you go to some places in the country and you feel like you've time traveled. There was a town in Texas that was like mostly an immigrant town and they had like these Ethiopian restaurants and no one in the restaurant spoke English. And I was like, where are we? And it was this weird little town in Texas.
That sounds delicious, first of all.
I don't know. If you went in there, you'd be like, what the hell is this place? I mean, it was just like one of those like pop-up tables and bare walls and like peeling, you know, wall stuff. And and there was like a guy in the back and they're like, oh, what do you want? And or whatever. And we're like, we're just actually going to go look for the pizza place.
Yeah. So. Like pizza. Do you, serve that? No. Okay. Bye.
And then he's like, I can cook some rice. And we're like, I don't know. It's just, that was, you know, so even traveling around the US, you get these kind of weird experiences. And so obviously every day you're traveling in Asia, you get those kind of experiences and they become mundane, you know, and there's points where I was traveling where I was like, I'm almost ready to go home. But then I don't know, like, I guess you go to a new place and new things come up and you kind of,
okay, so what were you looking for?
Right, right. So I was looking to be around people that weren't influenced or weren't westernized people and didn't necessarily have that tourist influence, because the tourist influence is a very strong influence, especially in Thailand.
Sure.
And those the Thai people are, you know, really awesome and really friendly, but they seem very much like they're catering towards the Western traveler.
Yeah.
Which they've been doing, you know, built up over 20 or 30 years or something. You know, it's been a gradual thing. But like and it's the same in Vietnam and Cambodia and those, and lots of those areas, but there's, you know, pockets where it hasn't changed and where you can, you know, take a bike or like everyone just drives mopeds everywhere.
Yeah.
And so you just like moped out into some little town and then you can like see how people are really living there. And also I think, like on a deeper level, I was really wanting to see a culture that wasn't driven as much by capitalism and consumerism. And I remember before I left, I'd been reading a lot of like books that, you know, like 1984 and Brave New World, and kind of interested in just concepts that are different than what our kind of country is doing. I don't know whether we were founded on it or what, you know, and whether it's this idea that, you know, everyone is an individual that has to go out there and make it in the world. And lots of these people, you know, it's not about going out and being the individual. It's about, you know, being responsible for your family and your community. And, you know, that was something that I felt kind of interested in, just kind of seeing a different perspective.
How much do you see the internet having an effect on these places?
Well, it's definitely changing, and not everyone, but lots of people are starting to get smartphones, and, you know, they can go on their smartphone and watch a YouTube video of whatever crazy stuff's happening in America. And, you know, a lot of people really look at America as a influential country, which I guess...
Of course.
Whether we're directly influencing them or, like, indirectly influencing them...
Well, we make all the media.
We are, like, a media monster, you know?
And yeah.
The media is a huge influencer of people, and yeah, I don't know. I kind of lost my train of thought.
No, I got you, man. I'm fascinated by the idea that like you can have little pockets. You can take a moped out to a village and see what a village looks like. Meanwhile, we're at home all tending to think of ourselves as like, what am I going to do for myself? You were saying to advance myself is a very like, I can see everything that's happening in the world on the internet and I can do that too better.
Yeah.
Rather than
yeah.
understanding like what it is to walk out the, you have to go outside and there's your village and you have to do your part to keep the culture moving.
Yeah. yeah.
We're like turning like inward towards our screens. And so I wonder if without the major influence of the internet, if those places are, if they like thrive as a culture because they aren't being ruined by the media coming from the West.
Yeah. So there's some that are, you know, thriving from the culture, but there's a lot of them that are being ruined by the West.
Yeah.
I worked on this farm in Cambodia that is owned by this French guy who's lived there for like 15 years and he's young, like in his like 38 or something, and he has a couple kids with a Cambodian woman, and it's like an organic, environmentally friendly, self-sustaining farm. It's, they call it, some cool words they drop are permaculture.
Cool.
Which I don't exactly know the complete definition of that, but I think you know they're trying to grow plants that grow there naturally, without necessarily just making a single crop. You know, they're trying to have pineapples and bananas and rice and other more foreign sounding plants, which I can't remember all their names.
Sure, of course.
And you know, so I was on this farm for 3 weeks and it was pretty amazing.
Permaculture literally is what you said, the development of agriculture ecosystems intended to be sustainable and self-sufficient.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, and Cambodia is in a really tough place right now because like 70% of their forest has been cut down.
To make palm oil?
Well, they aren't doing huge palm oil. They're mostly rice. Palm oil is mostly in Malaysia and those more like equatorial areas.
Sure.
Cambodia is a little bit more subtropic.
Yeah, forgive me. I don't know my geography well enough of the region.
No worries. There's this video on YouTube where you can actually see, I don't know whether it's like a live video, but they're showing like the forest deforestation happen. And so it shows all this green forest like receding. And this is like a 20-year period of time. And so with less forest comes like the whole environmental thing. If you've ever seen that awesome video about the wolves coming back to Yellowstone, it's just like that. With the forest going, the animals go. Without the animals in the forest, it like literally affects the climate, you know.
Yeah, I mean, like, the ecosystem changes because it has to support something changes. Different, yeah.
And this might be a little political, but I think that the term climate change or global warming is almost, you know, it's not quite there. What really is happening is environmental change, you know, and it's not just the temperature changing. It's the environment. It's like the ground and the rivers and all of that stuff, which makes a huge difference to the climate.
Well, a big concern for the world is the unfortunately, again, I'm not here to talk anyone into anything, but like, unfortunately, when you talk about climate change, like something that people don't discuss is like desertification.
Right,
Where cattle have stomped out or have taken a grassland and made it flat and the grass doesn't grow anymore and it becomes all exposed topsoil, which then goes up into the jet stream, which then redistributes somewhere else and you expand these deserts.
Yeah.
That's not scientific what I just said. That's just a general, really poorly painted picture. But it's that type of thing where it's not about there's too much carbon in the air or whatever. It's about like we're not taking care of the space that we have. Like when the Dust Bowl happened because they weren't rotating the crops enough and a drought came and boom, gone.
Right.
Like these types of things.
Right. It's a complete environmental thing more than just the temperature.
How much was the government like turning a blind eye to this?
The government's like doing this. There's people that are against this that, you know, are considered whatever rebels or bad guys, and you know, if they get caught, they're going to get arrested. But it's a lot of, I think Chinese, what they were saying, the locals were saying is Chinese are coming down and cutting these trees down because they're worth a lot, because they're like old growth jungle trees. And so a lot of the forests are gone. And so that's a big change that's happened in Cambodia over the last 20, 30 years. And also we've developed, you know, consumerism and capitalism over like 100-year period. And it's like capitalism hit them. And that's like everyone wants a phone. Everyone wants this. Everyone wants a TV in the last like 20 years. So trying to make that adjustment culturally is very difficult. And it's like if your parents grew up one way, the kid's completely different. You know, the kid wants to live like an American kid.
Yeah.
Whereas the parents grew up as like small communities with like farmers and they're living.
But now kids can see, they have a portal into
right.
what the rest of the world looks like.
And so you can't really say like they, you know, they deserve to have, you know, whatever we have. You know, it's, you can't really say you can't have this because it's going to be bad for the world and bad for your culture, right? So, I mean, globalization's happening. You can't stop it. It's just part of globalization.
That's the connection of information for all of us.
Right,
that's
right. Yeah. So, I feel like, you know, part of what you see is that things are changing, and you really can see that this change is happening, especially when you're like there and there's these kids on the street that are local that are on their phone, and then there's like these really poor people that can't ever afford a phone. Or
I can only imagine how crazy India is right now too, because of the how rapidly the education, job force, and manufacturing has sprung up.
Yeah, yeah.
Compared to the overwhelming poverty that happens there.
Yeah, yeah. So it's definitely, in general, like there's bigger gaps created, but you know, hopefully that as these people develop more of a upper class and middle class develop, they'll try to take the lower class with them. And
I'm going to say if. Yeah. Rather than when, if a middle class develops, then hopefully that becomes a...
But there is a middle class developing in a large middle class in Thailand and Malaysia and China, which seems to be growing as a middle class.
Yeah.
You know, people that are able to maybe go to school instead of start working at 13, you know.
Well, what were you surprised by, like, when you got there? That, like, what do you walk away from? I'll give you an example. I got to Japan and expected it to be all robots and lasers and lights and everything. And what I found was it was a bunch of sad people who don't talk to each other. They walk around like in solitude, and they like, so as my perception, so as not to bring shame on themselves by doing something impolite in public.
Okay.
And so you have like a bunch of people that don't, like, they don't gawk at the weird American guy walking around being giant and wowed by this culture. They like keep to themselves. And so it's, yeah. I walked away, instead of being like, they were awesome, I was like, I kind of feel bad for how inward they face and how sad that must be.
Yeah. Yeah. That's kind of a strange direction that the culture's, you know, provoked or pushed their mm-hmm. psyche or their, you know, interaction with people. I feel like something that was really powerful for me is like my first train ride in Thailand. I was on this night train and I met this guy. Like, everyone wanted to talk to me, you know. It was like,
oh really,
oh hi, like, just a guy by himself, and like I look quite a bit different than they do, and like just visually and taller and stuff, and
yeah.
They're all really friendly. And this guy who was like a 20-year-old college student, his name was Mook. He played in a rock band. I don't smoke cigarettes, but I smoked like 3 cigarettes with him on the train, and it was awesome because, you know, I could like hang out the doors in the middle of the night in Thailand going through this jungle, and like, this is the craziest train ride I've ever been on. And it's like a sleeper train, so I'm on like the top bunk, and so we talked to like 1 a.m. and he was like, you know what, Thailand is a king and you aren't allowed to talk about the king. So we had to like whisper when we talked about the king, and he would be like,
rest in peace.
And oh yeah, exactly. But you know, he was like, the youth, you know, don't necessarily support a monarch, you know, or the way that the government is basically run by a military, and the country is like sort of subjugated to tourism and, you know, catered towards this. You know, it's like they want a lot more than that. They think and know that there could be a lot more than that.
Wow.
And that's largely influenced by what they're seeing on their smartphones. You know, they're seeing like, well, they want to have their own identity and their own, you know, influence of the world, on the world, be part of the world, and don't be like, you know, a stomping ground for all these travelers to come just like chill on a beach. And, you know, a lot of travelers in Thailand aren't necessarily like the nicest people because they're just on vacation for a couple weeks and they aren't going to be like always super respectful.
I've heard there's a lot of D-bag Australians that come up there.
Yeah, and it depends on where you go. I mean, in some places, is, you know, you meet really cool travelers, and some places you meet really not cool travelers. And I met another kid in Vietnam who was like, you know, I wish that things were different in Vietnam. And they were like these young guys, like in their early 20s, and they wanted to talk about politics. And I don't know whether that's just normal, but like, I was pretty surprised. And,
yeah.
And you know, they were talking about wanting to go to school and wanting to, like, you know, change the way it is, you know, change the standard, which people are talking about here. People have been talking about that a lot this past year, obviously.
Yeah.
And with the election and stuff. And
it changed it in an interesting way here, let me tell you.
It changed, you know, surprised some of us, and, yeah, you know, maybe a bunch of people were pretty happy with it probably, but,
yeah.
I mean, that's the nature of change though, is someone's not going to be happy and someone will be happy. Mm-hmm. And that's one thing that I guess also is that if there's one thing you can guarantee is that there will be change. Like, there's always change.
There's a million small countries all in that area, like, that all have their own little customs and ways and everything. But was there, like, a what was the prevailing kind of, like, we're from the West, West people, Westerners think like this. What was the kind of the prevailing, like, we're from the East, this is how we think?
Well, they're changing. It's changing. And that's, like, one of the biggest
things. It's becoming more Western.
It's becoming more Western. Like, the young people want to, they want to be like the movies. And, like, yeah, so on Borneo, I stayed with a couch surfer. And, you know, he had like a family and stuff, and like a TV, and they had YouTube and stuff. And he was like, "So what's it like in America?" I'm like, "Oh, you know, it's not what you see on movies. Everyone just goes to work and does stuff." And he's like, "Yeah, but do you have house parties?" I'm like, "Oh yeah, I've had a house party for sure." And he's like, "Oh, you get drunk at your house parties?" I'm like, "Yeah." And he's like, "You invite your friends over?" I'm like, "Yeah." He's like, "Do you hook up with chicks?" I'm like, maybe, you know, that happens sometimes. And he's like, "Wow." He's like, "I've never had a house party." And I'm like, "What do you mean?" He's like, "Well, we go to the bar if we're going to drink, or go to karaoke." And everywhere is into karaoke, by the way. They love karaoke.
You're like, "Have you considered having a house party, sir?"
And he's like, "Maybe my wife goes out of town and we have a house party." And I'm like, "Whatever you want to do, man. I'm just here to, you know, see what you want to do." And like,
oh, weird, man. What a strange thing.
But then he was also asking some crazy stuff. He's like, "Oh, do you ever burn the house, like catch the house on fire?" I'm like, "No." And he's like, "I saw it in a movie." And you know, he was taking these ideas that he had seen in movies and asking me. And I've, you know, as much as it sounds ridiculous, like, he was serious about some of it. And he spoke English fairly well. And
well, it's like I think of all of the Far East being into karate, okay?
Right.
I saw zero martial arts throughout the entirety of Japan. So it's, yeah, like, I mean, it's there, I'm sure, but it wasn't like, that's the thing, we think of ninjas and Godzilla. Godzilla was everywhere, by the way. But like, we think of ninjas and Godzilla, and it's like, it wasn't there. Like, so
right.
I get it, that's what their perception of us is like,
yeah.
Muscle dudes with machine guns shooting stuff 20 years ago. Now it's house parties and Mercedes or whatever.
Yeah, And, you know, I think people think of Americans as, like, loud and not thoughtful, and that's sort of what our media, you know, people think of us as what our media has portrayed us as.
But did they think of it as Americans or Westerners? Because my experience, like, no one knew when we were in Japan, like, where we were from. They couldn't, like, pick it out. They couldn't pick out, because we don't speak the same language, and
right,
they didn't speak a ton of English.
Okay.
They, like, one guy, I cheered for, we were at a race, and I cheered for a German guy. "Yeah, German guy!" And the guy was like, "Oh, Germans!" And we were like, "No, USA." And he was like, "What? USA?" It was all white people from the West look and sound alike to them, which was fantastic. I loved having that turned back on me. I think
that's how it is, definitely, for people that don't speak the language, or if you don't talk to them for long enough for them to figure out who you are.
Sure.
So when I was in Borneo, I stayed with this at a longhouse. It was an Iban longhouse, which is the indigenous people from Borneo. They've lived there for whatever thousands of years.
And, cool.
And so they had they still had a traditional longhouse, and it's actually getting, like, very hard to find that sort of thing. But I got really lucky, because this group of people there from this company called Life Mosaic was at the longhouse, and their whole job is sort of basically the opposite of what the religious, what is it called when you travel? Religious travelers.
Like proselytizers or?
You know, when you, like,
missionaries?
Missionaries. It's the opposite of a missionary. Their job is to support the local culture, try to help the local people find an identity and, you know, improve the local traditions and cultures of the indigenous people, including language and things like that, which are fading. And, you know, there's languages that are dying, which, you know, is, you know, in some ways is sad, because that's going to be like, I just saw that movie, Arrival.
Oh, was it good?
I thought it was good. I enjoyed it.
I want to see it, yeah.
And this concept of language being the way you speak and write influences the way you think and view the world,
mm-hmm,
which is already a linguistic concept. But, you know, they bring it up in this movie. And if you think about these languages that are dying, these perspectives and ways to think about the world are also dying.
It's getting steamrolled by...
Right, it's getting steamrolled by the larger, more dominant ones, which are, you know, they've built up so much momentum. It's inevitable. It's gonna happen. But, you know, it's in some ways, being able to see some of them, it's an experience that I guess I wanted to have. And that was something I was looking for, you know, is to see kind of indigenous people and see how they were living, like I was saying earlier. So I was there for a week. I was only going to stay like 2 days. I ended up staying like 7 days. And
cool.
That's one of the great things about traveling with no time frame. And and on a cheap, low budget where you aren't necessarily worried about how much money you were spending or had because it was really cheap. And yeah, so this woman from Life Mosaic, who is an Indonesian woman, but she was there working with this indigenous tribe, afterwards has said, like, you changed the way I viewed Americans. Like, I thought Americans is one way, but we're different than how I, you know.
Oh, interesting.
So they do have a perception of Americans specifically, and I would say probably largely influenced by our massive media control. I mean, everyone there knows about, like, our presidential elections. I was like, you guys know more about, like, American politics than probably some Americans do because you're, like, into American media and American stuff. And
I went to an election night party with a bunch of British people, and they, like, except for the Electoral College, which I couldn't understand at all. Like, I can't either, but all of them knew more about what was going on than I did, for sure. And at some point I had to be like, listen, guys, I don't know. Like, you guys know more than I do, and I'm embarrassed to be here because I'm just here to, like, hang out and socialize, and, like, this is a moment in time. You guys actually know what's going on, and boy, shame on me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Tell me about something that went wrong for you while you were there.
You mean, like, missing buses or, like, okay, here, there's a story that I feel like I should tell you. I'll keep it, like, relatively short. So I was coming over the border into this area called West Kalimantan, which is a section of Borneo in the Indonesian side. Borneo's like one of the, I think, the third largest island other than, not including Australia, in the world.
Oh.
It's a really massive island. It's like, you know, hundreds of miles across.
Wow.
It's, you know, covered by jungle, lots of oil palm plantations. Part of it's Malaysia, part of it's Indonesia, and there's this little country called Brunei, which is in the
Sultan
side.
Of Brunei, is what I've heard before.
And so I was really interested in trying to see or be around more indigenous Iban people, which is the indigenous people, one of the indigenous groups on Borneo. And so I was traveling from the Malaysian side, which is more touristy and more built up, mm-hmm. to the Indonesian side, which is like, I couldn't find anyone that had been there. I was talking to all these people on the Malaysian side. I was like, hey, have you been to, you know, Kalimantan before, or the Indonesian side? And everyone's like, no, but, like, all the other travelers were like, no, but you should totally go. It's going to be really crazy. And it was like the craziest 2 weeks of my whole trip, probably. So coming over the border, there was this really strange guy on the bus, and he kept looking at me and, like, laughing. And, you know, he was kind of, like, creepy, like, older, bald, weird tattoos, and didn't really speak any English. But he showed me his passport, and it was like, I don't know whether he wanted to show me his name or where he was from. So I showed him my passport, which maybe wasn't a good idea in hindsight. But we get to the border, and he goes, you know, like, come with me. And I'm like, you know, there's a whole bunch of people there, and we're outside. So I'm walking with
him. This is a horror movie to me. No.
I'm walking with him towards the border, and we get to the border, and he goes, like, he's somehow conveys that he knows the guy. And so he's like, I'd give him my passport, and he gives it to the border guy, and the guy talks to him. I don't talk to the border guy at all. Normally you have to pay like 30 or 40 bucks to get a visa to go into Indonesia. Malaysia, you don't have to pay. You know, every country's a little different.
Yeah, sure. Ooh.
And so I get a visa exempt stamp, and I don't pay anything. So it means I don't need a visa, which I'm like, okay, that's kind of odd, whatever. And so I come back, and I'm like, kind of always talk in broken English, unless the person speaks English well, because when you use the full sentence, it kind of can get confusing.
So, I gotcha.
So I'm like,
noun verb.
You know, yeah. So I'm like, bus station, you know, I go to Singkawang, and he's like, oh no bus, Singkawang tomorrow. I'm like, oh crap. So I have to stay in this border town. And you know, border towns in general, even border towns in America on the Mexican side can be somewhat,
Nogales. Been there.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm like, all right, well, I guess I'll go to a hotel or something. And he's like, oh, no, come with me. So his friend drives up in like a decent looking like Ford Explorer with like blacked out windows. And his friend's young and speaks English. Like, he's like probably in his 30s. And his friend's like, hey, what's up, brother? He's like, hop in, dude. I'll take you like wherever you need to go. I'm like, all right, cool. Like, you seem pretty normal. And so I hop in, and then we drive past the border guy, and like the other check where they check my visa and make sure I had it stamped. And they're like, they know the guy, you know? And so they know like all the border guys, and the border was sketchy in itself. It was like getting remodeled or built maybe it was just getting built for the first time for that matter, because it's kind of in the jungle and there's like these, you know, just to help you with some visuals, you know, like I'm walking on like these muddy boards over this like muddy pit and there's all these guys sitting around like without their shirts, like smoking, and I'm the only white person there and probably one of the only people that speak English, and I don't speak any of their languages. And so I like have my big backpack and I'm like, you know, this is towards the end of my trip. This is probably like, I've been traveling for 5 months. So I was like, all right, you know, I've seen some stuff. I can handle myself. And so I go with this
guy. Are your spidey senses tingling this whole time?
My spidey senses are tingling. I'm like, oh man, stay on top of this. Like, you know, I was just being very aware. So we go back to this like shop and he's like, hey, this is my brother's shop. And it ends up that he's like a border like runner. And so he has like all these passports of Indonesian passports that he's like getting his people in so they can work, because Malaysia has a better economy right now in mm-hmm. that area. And so it's basically like completely illegal.
Yeah.
But he knows all the border guys. And so we go, and there's like checkpoints on the road here and there. And so we drive past a checkpoint and he rolls it down. And he's like, talks to the guy and then drives off. And so it gets like really uncomfortable because he's like, do you want to stay at a hotel or do you want to stay here? And I was like, oh, well, how much? And he's like, well, here's like whatever, you know, $2, or you can stay at the hotel for $10. And I'm like, oh yeah, $2. Sure. No problem. I'll stay in like a grimy room for, you know, really cheap. And it seemed okay at the time. You know, it was like, you know, I met his family, like I had dinner with him and like, I had just met this guy. Like I just jumped in his car and he was like pretty nice. But, I saw his room and like literally him and his wife and his four kids lived in like a single room inside this like really grungy, like just wood building.
What did you eat?
Like rice and fish.
Cool.
Yeah. And like his wife had made it or something. And you know, like in his room, all he had was a guitar, which we played, and like this big dagger, like on the wall. That was it. And like a pile of clothes and like a mattress on the ground. And I was like, wow, this is some like, you know, oh, it was crazy. And
it's sad, sort of. Yeah.
And yeah, sad, but kind of unnerving a little bit. And then he has this nice car and it was kind of weird. And so he's like, oh, do you want to go to, you know, the strip club? And I was like, no, I mean, I don't really need to go to the strip club. What do you normally do? You know, I'll do whatever. And I didn't really plan to stay there. So I was kind of like, what do I do tonight? So he's like, well, let's go get coffee. I'm like, all right. So he picks up the guy again, the creepy bald guy that with the tattoos, who's like his buddy. And he gets in the car and then he picks up this woman who's like this young, thin, kind of like sexy looking Asian woman. And he's like, oh, do you want to sleep with her? And I was like, oh no, it's okay. And so he probably asked me like 8 times if I wanted to sleep with her, like hounding me on that. And so I think basically they wanted me to pay money to sleep with her. And so he was probably going to get some of that money or something.
Yeah.
But he went and it had gotten dark by now and it was like raining.
Do you have your bag on you or do you leave it at his house?
I left my bag in my room, which had a lock on it, but it was his lock. And so I he's like, oh, you didn't leave anything in the room? I'm like, no, just clothes. And he's like, okay. He's like, you have your passport and stuff? I'm like, yeah, yeah. And then I started thinking like, maybe someone's like going through my stuff, or maybe he wants my passport and he's going to like rob me, because he's a passport runner and a U.S. passport. And he knows I'm from the U.S. because his friend saw my passport. And so I'm kind of like, oh shit, like, what do I do? You know? And so he's driving to this coffee place and he drives through a town and it's been like a 10-minute drive down this windy road in the jungle and it's dark and raining. And there's these, you know, three of them in the car and they're all talking and I don't understand anything they're saying. And he keeps asking me if I want to sleep with this woman. I keep saying, no, no, just coffee. It's okay. And so I'm like, hey, look, like how much farther is it to the coffee? And he's like, oh, sorry, it's a good one. You know, it's like the next town. And I'm like, okay, well, I'm kind of tired. I've been traveling all day. I'm going to wake up early and travel tomorrow. And,
yeah.
And he's like, okay, yeah, we'll be there soon. And then this woman in the back starts crying. And then he yells at her. He's like, you know, he's like, shut up. And then they're kind of laughing again. And I was just like, what the heck is going on here? And so I'm like, dude, like, I don't feel comfortable with this. And then right as I said that, he pulls into this coffee place and he's like, it's okay. You know, he's like, we're here. And so we sit down and he buys her coffee. And then he's like, do you want anything? And I'm just like, I'm just going to drink my water, actually. Like, I'm good. I don't even want to drink coffee because I felt like, you know, they're going to like drug me or something's going to happen. You know, you hear about these weird things.
Yeah, you're just on your...
And so also my mind is like, anything that could happen might happen. So I'm just like on guard. I'm just like drinking my water bottle and like, yeah, it's all good. You know, I'm just hanging out, like trying to keep it cool or whatever. And the creepy bald guy just kind of is smiling the whole time, and he's like, ha, ha, ha. He does this like weird kind of like, he looked like a Star Wars character, like he would laugh and like, ah, ja, 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 you know, I don't know, something crazy like that.
Yeah.
And yeah, so then he's like, all right, well, let's go back. And so we're driving back, and I'm like, okay, thank God. Like, I paid attention the whole way, you know, I was kind of like, there was only like one turn that we took. And we're really close, and he takes a left-hand turn up a gravel road. The middle is pitch black.
You start peeing your pants.
And I'm like, I'm going to die. No, I seriously thought, like, this guy's going to probably, like, take me somewhere and knock me out and take all my shit and leave me on the side of the road. And I'm not going to have a passport or money or a phone. And what am I going to do? Like, I'm going to be super...
Do you keep your phone in your pocket this whole time to, like...
Yeah, actually, I think I had my phone, and he had helped me get my phone set up so I had an Indonesian line. Yeah. Because it's, like, different when you get over the border. So I think I had messaged somebody that I had met in the last town, and I was like, hey, I'm kind of in an uncomfortable situation, so I just want you to know where I am. Like, I literally was like, this is where I am at right now. And so we're driving down this gravel road, and I was like, whoa, why do we take this road? Like, the place we were staying at is just around the corner. I know we aren't far. And he's like, oh, no, it's okay, it's okay. And he's like, it comes back around. I'm like, no, like, just take me home. And yeah, like, I think I was probably, like, shaking. Like, my heart was pounding. And I grabbed my hand on the door, like, in case I had to, like,
jump
and roll. I mean, he's not going fast. It's gravel, and it's pitch black. And it's raining. And she started crying again and stuff. And I'm like, what is going on? I'm like, dude, seriously? Like, I'm not comfortable with this. I'm like, I dropped some language. I was like, pull the car over. I need to go home right now. Or whatever, like, turn around. And he's like, it's fine, it's fine. And I shift the car into neutral because I was sitting shotgun. I shift the car into neutral. I'm like, no, dude, I'm not joking. Like, take me back right now. And he's like, okay. Like, and he turned off and took me back. And that was the most I've ever had to, like, feel like I had to assert myself. And also the closest I felt, like, you know, really vulnerable. You know, I was in this car with these two guys and this woman, and one of the guys spoke some English. And, like, in the middle of, like, a rainy rainforest in Borneo, which is kind of like, I mean, the border town for that matter, you know, it's pretty far in. It's not next to any big towns. It was just like this little hole in the wall town. And so he drove me back, and he was like, hey, you sure you don't want to come? Like, you can, I'm going to go out with my buddies. I'm like, no, I'm going to go to bed. And
I
was
freaked out, dude.
Yeah. I was scared, like, pretty. but you know, I calmed down. I just sat there in the bed and was like, Wusa, and like read for a while, and woke up in the morning and left, and it was fine.
Did you sneak out without saying anything?
He said that he had to do something. He was like, I have to wake up at 4 a.m. and do a border run. And I was like, he's like, but I'm going to come back. I'll give you a ride to the bus station, because it was like whatever, a mile or two away. And I woke up and he wasn't there. And he said the bus left at 7. So I like just walked out to the street, and this guy at like a store was, I mean, they don't see Western travelers there at all, like, yeah, hardly ever, as far as I could tell. I mean, I didn't see a single Western person the whole time I was in Kalimantan for 2 weeks. And yeah, and this guy was like, hey, I'm like, hey, do you know how far the bus is? And he's like, I give you a ride.
Not again.
But it was daylight, so I felt much safer. And
what was the border town called? Do you remember? Were you coming from Brunei, is that what you said?
No, I was coming from Kuching.
I'm just looking at it. Doesn't matter, man. I'm just looking at the map on Google Maps here.
Actually, I did bring my journal, so I have all my like places that I was at. I wrote a journal while I was traveling. I filled a whole entire journal, and yeah, it was really great. But
that's so awesome to be able to go back and look at that sometime.
Yeah, yeah. I read it like a couple weeks ago. I looked at it. I was like, oh yeah. Like, you definitely, when you read something, all of the memories like flood back, like the visuals and the people, and you know, like, you can think about it and you can talk about it, but it's really hard to remember some of those details unless you...
Did you journal every night?
No, there'd be times where I did it like once a week, and there'd be times where I did it every night. So definitely when I was on my own, I tried harder to do it more frequently. And
did your traveling satisfy that itch or only intensify it?
It satisfied it to an extent, but it, you know, like, okay, when I left to travel, I wanted to go to India. I was like, I'm going to go to Thailand and maybe like Cambodia, Laos, Vietnam, and then maybe India. But I did really want to do some meditation or spend some time around like Buddhist monks, because that was something I had been interested in. Mm-hmm. And I also knew that I wanted to spend some time maybe doing like working at a farm, like an like the farm that I was working at was called Organic. And so I was like looking at Woofing and Workaway, HelpX kind of stuff, but I kind of figured out everything word of mouth. Like I was at a hostel and I met this guy and he was telling me about this awesome farm that he was at in Cambodia. And so I messaged the guy on Facebook and the guy replied and I was there for 3 weeks, you know, with a group of other travelers. And that was really a really awesome experience. Lots of fun staying, you know, on this farm in Cambodia. And then I also knew I wanted to. So with the meditation stuff, I did a yoga class in Siem Reap, which is a large-ish town in Cambodia. And the yoga instructor was like this really crazy kind of Irish/South African guy who had been doing yoga and meditation since he was like a teenager, and he was like in his 50s now, and he had these crazy stories about living in Ireland and working with this like meditation center that ended up becoming a cult, and like he had to escape on like a motorcycle and this woman was like trying to drain his energy and like all this crazy stuff. But he was like, the most legit authentic meditation I've ever done is called Vipassana meditation, and there's Vipassana centers all around the world. And so I was like, oh, I'll look into it. And it's like a 10-day silent meditation. And I did that in Malaysia.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so that was really crazy experience too. So I did the farm and then I did the meditation in Malaysia. And then from there, I knew I wanted to like be in less cities and less touristy areas. So that's why I ended up going to Borneo. And so kind of all these things sort of fell into place. It's one of those things where you look back at the timeline and how it all worked out, and you're like, wow, that couldn't have been, you know, any more perfect in how it all worked out. And so I feel like I got in a really good place of kind of, I guess, being in tune with what I was wanting out of my trip and my experience, and being really aware of myself and being able to find that. And so when it ended, I was like ready for it to end and to come back. And I still want to go to India. So I also want to go back to Borneo because the Longhouse was a really amazing experience. I got some tattoos there. And
oh, cool. I see that. That's cool.
I spent some time in the jungle with this group, Life Mosaic, that was working with the youth about, you know, the importance of their culture. And it's sort of like summer camp, but not. And all these kids are amazing. These kids like go into the jungle and bring back like vegetables and fish. And then we cook it and we ate it at night. And that was like, they live like off the jungle. They don't have like, you know, jobs at all. I mean, it's not a consumer. They don't live in, I mean, there is an influence of that and it's changing and like everything is, but they don't live as in like wanting to go to the bar or wanting to like go to their friend's house and play video games. Like, and they were the happiest people I've ever seen probably. Like they were laughing. We would sit around in circles in the Longhouse drinking this beer. It's called Tuak. They also called it tree beer. It's like a rice beer, I think, that's made with like the bark of a tree. And they had like these big buckets of it, and it's kind of like a white creamy color, and they just filter it right there through this like piece of cloth. And yeah, so I mean, that was maybe a lot of information kind of all over the place, but you know, it was one of those experiences where it's like, this is really amazing. I had a really good connection with some of the other, like the younger guys there that were like in their late 20s, early 30s. And they were like, come back, you know, help us learn English. Cause they didn't really speak any English. And so I think, and they're like, you could come and stay for a month or something. So, you know, like I almost can't, you know,
is it worth it though to do that border experience again?
I think I'd go through a different border.
Yeah.
Maybe, you know, maybe find the guy again and bring him like $50 or something, like US dollars, that would like change his life or something, maybe, you know, so.
Smart.
But so I ended my trip in Kota Kinabalu, which is a town in Malaysia.
Direct flight back to Seattle from Kota Kinabalu?
Direct flight. No, I had to go to Shanghai, but it was just a short layover, which is kind of cool that I was in China.
Sure.
I met this woman who has been traveling for like a year and a half or 2 years or something. And she was saying that she had left to go home for a wedding or something and ended up staying home for a year and then started her travels again from the city she had left off. And so I think that's kind of cool. I might start from where I left off, work my way back to the Longhouse, and then work my way through Indonesia, maybe into India that way. So
we could keep going for hours, I'm sure. I didn't even ask you about, like, if they do drugs there, if they have, like, Coca-Cola, any of that stuff.
So much Coca-Cola.
Thanks for coming, dude.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You've been listening to So You're in Seattle with Gregor. Follow him on Twitter at HeyGregor. Find more episodes online at SoYou'reInSeattle.com. So You're in Seattle is a Burrito Butt production.
Yeah, you're a good dog chowder.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.